this is just indicative of how everything has to be trumped up as the most important thing in the world just to get the likes and the clicks, and it really increases the cost for cybersecurity.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial?
Adversarial.
It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast with Jerry, Mario, and Sunil. Good to see you guys. We've got a lot more news, like it's the case every single week. First, a little look back, right? I think we made some predictions on stock prices last week. How are you guys feeling about those after everything rolled through?
I'll say for one thing, if war breaks out in the Middle East, all bets are off anyway. So, but that's it. I was hoping that CrowdStrike would have a nicer bump back up, but it hasn't happened. I think it will still happen, but that's it.
Yeah,
I'm more shocked. I was pretty shocked. I didn't think it was the stock was going to get beat that badly, and it seems like it continues to get beaten in, today and yesterday as well.
Well, today keep in mind there's a broader market movement that's happening as well. So.
That's correct. Yeah,
and Mario, I mean, that's it. You got to get credit here. I mean, you nailed this thing. You're the only one who said it was going to be down.
But you're the one who picked the whole Wiz thing. Wiz and
well, thanks. I got some. Wiz, I got one right? Out of two right. Yeah. But I had, I think, $340 or something like that for the Thursday close, and it was what, 260 or something like that, 250 maybe, and now we're like 215. So yeah, it's getting beat down for a while here. I think a lot of that has to do with. Not the lawsuit from Delta, not the class action lawsuit, but the fact that all those Delta screens were down for so many people walking through the airport for so many days.
Yeah, it's definitely not a good not a good look for the company that has to deal with it. I think, though, there is a more interesting thing that's emerging from this whole lawsuit, which is what are the limits of software liability? And that's, as folks may know, in the national strategy, cybersecurity strategy, that was something that was brought up as a major pillar. And I can only imagine that conversation is now going to be amplified. I don't think, we'll see what happens. This is another prediction that may go horribly wrong, but I don't think Delta is going to win this lawsuit. They're probably going to have to settle somewhere behind the scenes, but it will leave the question of software liability still an open question. And now imagine, if you will, to Jerry's point just a moment ago, let's say it's not settled. Let's say it goes to jury, okay? I mean, even if the laws say that the company is not liable for software, there's no software liability, can you imagine being in a jury where you have people who saw this happen? They're like, yeah, I was affected too, right? Or whatever it might be. And they're like, how come we don't have software liability? Anyway, I just don't see this. If I were on the CrowdStrike side, I would not want to see this go to trial because it just, you wouldn't have the juries, you wouldn't be in the juries. Grace, you know, they wouldn't see you positively.
So I agree with you, Sunil. The other question that I have as a follow-up is Delta going to get rid of CrowdStrike as their vendor? And if so, what would they do? Who are they going to choose? Is another vendor going to be any better? What do you guys think?
Pure optics. I think they'll get rid of them just so there's not Exhibit F during the case of, well, why didn't you get rid of it? But getting rid of them in a large organization, especially one that I always thought Delta was pretty tech forward, but I think a lot came out of this that makes them look not tech forward, and a not tech forward organization getting rid of something like this is a 5-year process anyway.
Yeah, could you imagine you got rid of it, and in the transition period, you get compromised in some way. That looks even worse, if effectively. And I think to Jerry's point, keeping in mind that the real issue is not the software that you're using, but rather how you design your environment so that it's resilient to any sort of IT outages. We should design towards failure. And that is, I would argue, the fact that one airline suffered as much as they did versus another airline that didn't, that tells you something, right?
Yeah, but I mean, the anecdotes that I'm hearing about companies that weren't impacted by this were that they were kind of, that they were even further back, like that they were on, you know, such old software that they couldn't even play in this game. Whereas the middle ground was the guys who did get hit, did have an impact, and then were able to recover. And I think that's really the role models, right? Because otherwise you can't tell lucky apart from good.
So do we think people are going to start leaving CrowdStrike then, or is just going to pass and CrowdStrike will get a little bruised up, and then but they'll continue to grow their business?
I don't know. I surveyed some CISOs to talk about it, and at the time I did, it was mostly no, we're not going to leave. There was some, and I gave them the option of we are going to. There was a nice middle chunk of we're going to demand relief from CrowdStrike. But among that, more than 50% of them said they were more or less bluffing. Meaning I gave them the choice of, like, if you're going to ask, are you going to walk if they don't give you anything or not? And most of them were like, eh, no, we're not really. So, you know, never miss an opportunity to try. I think functionally it's not prudent to abandon over this. And I think anyone who does is simply trying to manage by magazine and optics wise, and oh yeah, those are bad. Don't worry, we got them. I'm pulling them out, boss. More than actually doing a risk assessment on it.
What I would want to know what the CEOs of these companies think. I mean, I would think the discussion would be with the CISOs or the technology department, the IT department. What's our backup plan? What happens when we, you know, not backup as in replacing CrowdStrike, but to your point, Jerry, what's our backup plan when some of these outages happen? I mean,
concentration risk.
I think it's a time to do a little self-reflection, folks. You know, what's your backup plan look like?
Yeah, my assumption here is that in a lot of CISO CEO meetings, that the way it's happening, whether it's at a board meeting or before it, is that the CEOs are saying, hey, do we use CrowdStrike? That's first, right? And sometimes the answer may be, yeah, that's why we had a big outage, didn't you remember? But especially for people who didn't have an obvious outage, do we use CrowdStrike? And if the answer is yes, then yeah. I mean, I think the CEO is saying, ooh, what's up with that? Are we getting rid of them? And I think a good CISO says either, look, we analyze the risk behind this thing and they have a great track record and we're not making a move. Or they say, yeah, we looked at it and we looked into what they did and the root cause analysis, and we are getting rid of them. We don't feel they were good. Those are both fine. But unfortunately, a big chunk, 40% maybe, of CISOs are just going to react to, yes, sir. You know, and you know, the CEO says, are we getting rid of them? A lot of people interpret that as, why aren't we getting rid of them? And I know that because it happens in regulatory exams all the time. The regulators come in and say, do you allow printing? Yes, sir. I didn't even give you a command. All down the ranks. We're not allowed to print anymore. The regulator said so. And no one questions it because there's a legal wall. And I think there's a lot of like rubber stamp CISOs that the minute the CEO says, why aren't we getting rid of them? We're working on it. We're working on it right now. Instead of just saying, well, that's a good point. I haven't done the research yet. I'll dig in. We'll do a risk analysis, which people should do. And I think CEOs would appreciate that too. They're just asking. So yeah, we'll see about that. And on the specific lawsuits here, you know, you said, Mario, something like that the jury might not view them as favorably. But, you know, what's working in CrowdStrike's favor is that kind of the entire U.S. trade ecosystem is going to be on their side. Because if you set precedent here on your skylight leaked, and therefore everything that was damaged under it, you know, people are on the hook for, or, you know, I was going to use tires, but like your bike tire popped while you were riding and you crashed, and all of a sudden everybody's, you know, there's so much fine print already saying at your own risk and on, and it's there for a reason. And if that's all invalidated, I mean, whew, that's a lot of waves for a lot of companies, including Delta. Delta probably doesn't like that outcome either. Because there's probably a whole lot of stuff that you sign about not getting COVID when you're on the airplane or whatever else right now that they're leveraging and they don't want to have all thrown out with the bathwater.
We'll see what new precedents are created as a result of this. But I think we have to tread with caution because we may open up a whole new can of worms. That said, I think there is still... I'm still trying to figure out where I sit in terms of being in favor of software liability. I think there is a need for something along those lines. It's really a question of to what extent and how far do we want to go in imposing some form of liability.
Yeah. Well, I think there's, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I have a basically paralegal undergraduate degree, which means I'm really not a lawyer. But look, there's two thresholds here. One is, hey, despite all of the disclaimers and warnings you had, we still think that you're still culpable here. And that's the macro problem of, you know, there's a lot of disclaimers in the world. Are we going to invalidate all of them? But then there's on, you know, almost always, regardless of all the disclaimers you put in the world, if you can prove gross negligence, then that trumps that without major precedent, right? Because that's always been the case. If there's gross negligence, you can't paper that away. And so then the other angle is, can they prove gross negligence, which usually has a willful component? And I mean, to me, that's patently not the case here, that they were trying to undermine. They're not into that at all. But I did see a competitor come out and throw out those words, throw them around, you know, massively negligent here. And I think that's unprofessional anyway, but I think it's very irresponsible when it could cross a threshold that would just be existential for them. I don't think that's accurate.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I was, again, so disappointed when a competitor of CrowdStrike just you know, took advantage of the situation. And it just doesn't come across well, guys. If you're a competitor of CrowdStrike or a competitor of any of these other companies that has one of these experiences, one of these outages, breaches, et cetera, just save the powder for later. All right, it reflects really poorly on your companies.
Yeah. And then the other lawsuit, the class action. Yeah, I was talking to some people about that, and having traded in public equities for a long time, anytime something goes down a bunch, it's probably algorithmically driven right now. There's a class action organized. You know, there's probably some code that literally reads. It's not even AI. It's just if then, create class action lawsuit. I've had so many, you know, you get the paper mail in that case that says, you know, you can be a party to this if you held the stock between this period and that. So that's not even interesting to me. And I think, like, especially large institutional investors and fund managers have some almost fiduciary obligation to get upset whenever the stock goes down and rally just to show that they're protecting a shareholder interest. I don't think those are super sincere or it's going to have any special stick here unless gross negligence is proven, something like that.
Yeah, on the topic of gross negligence, I think this is where hindsight bias really factors in. And unfortunately, people will look back at the event and say, oh, how come you couldn't have seen this coming? And of course, the reality is nobody would have been able to see it coming if you played it forward. The hindsight bias is strong and alive in cybersecurity quite often as well. And I think when we look at, for example, even the most recent stuff with Azure or AWS going down too, the complex systems fail in complex ways. And we cannot anticipate those until we put actual failure scenario, or we try a wide range of actual failure scenarios, chaos engineering, if you will, and see what actually breaks and, you know, be able to handle it. Can we anticipate every possible break? No. But can we build in the muscle memory around how we handle these sort of events very quickly and efficiently? That's what we really should be striving to do. I don't think we can we can't anticipate every possible failure point, but we can play out failure points so that we are ready for whatever future failure point may come in.
Yeah.
Assume failure.
Yeah. Just to add to that, you know, there's that Microsoft and AWS outages are becoming a wake-up call for cloud dependency. What I would argue is, why are you only using AWS? Why are you only using Microsoft? Why are you only using GCP? I know it's complex. I know it's challenging to have to deal with different cloud providers. But I think the real thing, or the more interesting thing, would be to have deployment in different cloud providers. So you're not depending on any one cloud provider. And then you might say, well, Mario, we can't do that. We don't have the time to do that. Well, go work or partner up with SaaS vendors to do that, right? Is that SaaS vendor you're working with or you're using, do they have different deployments in different cloud providers? And if so, great. That's a good approach. Have you done some redundancy testing? Can I move data from one cloud provider to the other, and how seamless is it? I think this is an opportunity not to say, oh, cloud providers are bad, you should go develop your own solution. I think it's a time to leverage your redundancy across multiple providers.
Yeah, I agree with you in theory, But boy, I mean, especially to a layperson listening, it is really hard. And it's the cloud providers, but it's also the CDNs. Like, I think those two go hand in hand, right? So I'll use myself as an example. My startup is on one CDN and one cloud provider. On the roadmap, there's a roadmap over here. There's actually a phase over here, and it has diversification off the CDN as part of it. And I think I'm pretty forward-leaning, and I know this tech, and I grew up with it. So I was able to say, like, well, hold on, let's not leverage bespoke functionality in the cloud provider, right? So Cloudflare, Workers, AWS, Lambda, and so on. Unless we have cloud diversity or CDN diversity first, because once you do that, then everything gets a lot more complicated. But that's pretty unique to even recognize it. I think most people, your engineering teams are slowly, because at day one, everyone agrees you only need one cloud provider. Your backers, your funders, your VCs would penalize you for wasting time and money on going across three cloud providers before you even, you know, have gone to market here. So everybody knows that's a day three thing. But what you forget is that in day one and two, you've got an army of engineers you're hiring that are going to make it more and more difficult and raise the switching, not the switching costs, the diversification costs even. Mm-hmm. It becomes so hard. So I totally agree with you, Mario, and I think that needs to move up the stack, the awareness of, and it can't be like, oh, we're only on one, let's go to two, yay. It's got to be, what would it take to go to two?
Right.
And nine times out of ten, that conversation, if it's really accurate, is going to be, let's stick with one. Shared fate, right? AWS goes down. Look, there's blood in the streets. Everybody walks out and stops working anyway. We're going to get a lot of sympathy from the market. We're just going to roll with that. Crazy?
No, it's definitely a cost. I mean, I'm actually considering right now, we have somebody who can do AWS DevOps. And as we start deploying it to Azure, that means I need to pay for another person that can do Azure DevOps. And unfortunately, the intersection between those who can do both is a very small intersection.
Yeah. And you know, if you're using basically lift and shift cloud, you know, where you basically have VMs running everywhere, which we all denigrate, then it's actually easier because you can shift to different cloud providers. But if you actually moved workloads into whatever bespoke offering is in each cloud platform, then the more you do that, the harder it is to find the analog in the other provider. And by the way, it's not parity, right? Sometimes somebody comes out with something first. So you got to find it, make sure it's on all two or three, translate into it, hire the engineer. I don't think there's a lot of companies at scale that are doing a good job of that. And not to mention, God forbid that one of those cloud providers is listed on your stock exchange or underwritten by your bank or anything else, and you have political reasons that you're not going to diversify.
But even if you're using one cloud provider, you should be using different regions, right?
Yes.
At minimum, right, folks?
Yes.
That's
like totally
the
great
idea that S3 is going to go down across everywhere in the world, or at least in the country. Just everything I know about AWS and Azure and GCP, just go to different regions, man, even if it's the same cloud provider.
Yeah.
So let's actually consider also, let's not over-rotate on very low probability risks, right? The fact that both Azure and AWS had an outage at the roughly around the same time, if that were purely accidental, the probability of that happening should be extraordinarily rare. And we just rolled the dice the other day and it, you know, came up unlucky. But the probability of that happening again is going to be exceedingly rare, right? This is separate from the target attacks, okay? But how we think about resiliency in the context of a targeted attacks, it's going to be different than how we think about resiliency in the context of just everyday sort of failures that we can actually engineer and design for.
That's right. And the targeted attacks can just follow you to all the different cloud providers, or they're going to figure that out too, and then you wasted all your money.
That's right.
And I'll tell you, not to pile onto that unique subject, but my career was somewhere that had the motivation and the resource to really try to tackle this problem when it came to like data center diversity, at least, which, by the way, that was so much easier before cloud, right? The data center, different brand on the thing, different, guards, different city. But even when we accomplished that, we realize that you have to test it, and people do that, right? Oh, yeah, we're going to test DR. We're going to power down the data center. We're going to move, or maybe you're going to do that within across regions, that sort of thing. And you do it on the weekend, on Saturday, whatever. But after suffering outages and caring a lot, we ultimately started failing over whole business units, whole sectors, to a different data center and running live for a week. So it was, you know, ops knew. They were like, oh, where's, you know, this business running? Okay, this is the week. And it was like 1 week, a year, if not a quarter. So it wasn't a lot. But in other words, we're open for business Monday morning, and it's things are happening in the secondary data center. And until you did that, it was all paper and promises, you know, because you learn things when you really run live. It's not like people think.
I still think it's a business opportunity for a lot of SaaS providers. Okay, I'm going to, again, coming from a SaaS world, if you're looking at two different vendors who are in the same industry or provided the same services, one is not mature enough to have multiple different cloud deployments and redundancy, and the other one is, but it's going to charge you a little bit more money. You know, it's probably worth it, folks.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. Yeah, 5 years ago it was big bank says, if you can fork it and give me something on-prem, then you can charge me 10x.
Yeah.
And tomorrow it's going to be, if you can prove that you're in two or three cloud providers, then you can charge me 6x. Hey, before we get off of outages and that sort of thing, one of the things that popped up last week was Microsoft and having an Azure outage linked to DDoS attack, and it didn't take long in the article to realize that what they said was basically they were under a DDoS attack, not having an impact, or certainly the one that led to the to an article being written, and then they did something, and during their reaction,
the Microsoft people did something.
Microsoft,
yeah.
Own goal that they somehow caused their own impact, and I definitely have an anecdote through that. Did that resonate with any of you guys?
So let me first comment on this one. Let's just first agree that Azure is always under a DDoS attack.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
All right. Yes. So when the article first came out and said, oh, this was the cause of this outage was because of a cyber attack. Like, no, it was not because of a cyber attack.
Or a DDoS attack specifically.
Or a DDoS attack specifically. It's always under a DDoS attack. Mm-hmm. And so then now the question is, I mean, by the way, it's not to say that a real large-scale DDoS attack can't cause an outage. Obviously, it can, right? Obviously, we have seen such things happen. But there's a little bit of clickbait aspect of this that I think we got caught by, which it just needs to be mindful that it wasn't I wouldn't count this as a cyber attack.
It's interesting because it starts to split hairs over something that everybody dealt with last week, which was, is the outage of a security tool a cyber event or an operational event? So likewise, you got a DDoS attack, you definitely have a cyber event. But if that's just a SEV3, and then all of a sudden you do something operationally that interrupt service, and that's your criteria for a SEV2. Is the cyber attack elevated, or is there an operational incident that's up there and the cyber one stays down low? And it matters these days because you get into reporting and disclosure obligations and SEC requirements about it. I think if you try to make that argument and say, look, it was DDoS, but that was low severity, that's why we didn't notify the investing public, that's why we didn't AK, that's why we didn't tell this regulator, and then we screwed something up ourselves and that's not reportable, I think if you're explaining, you're losing. I don't think people are going to make that call.
Ooh, yeah. To me, this is one of the one of those cardinal sins that I used to tell my teams. You know, you just hope you never, as a security organization, your actions bring down your company services. It's like the worst thing, right? Like that's the one where you lose. I hate to say this, folks. You lose credibility afterwards. You know, it was that security patch. You told everybody, we got to go do it. Wake up, everybody. Go deploy it. And all of a sudden, it breaks the business. And oh, boy. You lose. Try to do that again next time. It's my worst. It's my worst nightmare.
So on that topic, then, we have a couple security vulnerabilities that have popped up recently that I think the question is hype or not hype, right? There was one that came up just recently around PK fail. It was we had all these hardware manufacturers using essentially like an example token, or sorry, example certificate that was leaked at some point, and so somehow we didn't have some sort of indication that we should never use that key again, and yet it gets baked into a lot of hardware going forward. Now, the issue is real, and it does give the attackers an opportunity to entrench themselves into at a much deeper level. But the question is this overhyped? And I don't know yet. I think I'd like to understand, like, what criteria should we consider to see whether this is overhyped or not? And one can argue that the how expansive the concern is and how easily one can execute on it. And also, lastly, maybe, are people actually taking advantage of it? I think those are maybe some of the factors. But that's it. Anyway, I'd love to get your opinion on that one.
Well, I definitely have some passion on this whole topic, right? And so my take on it, and so stepping back a little bit from encryption keys to signed firmware, I think that what the layperson, and I'm including board directors and CEOs and you know, people that are lay to cybersecurity.
Or well, audit companies as well.
Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah, yeah, audits examiners, reg examiners, all that. What they might learn from this podcast episode, to give a little insight into the day in life of not just a CISO, but of an entire security department, we get this fire hose of headlines that are sensationalized coming at us because companies that have nothing to do with security research initially all now have security research teams. And it's and they're looking for anything close to a vulnerability, which is great for the world, seems like it, but they're for-profit entities. They're doing that so that the minute they find anything, they're going to have a press release and try to get their name snuck in alongside something. And it really inflates the amount of staff and spend that CISOs are hiring because every time one of these comes across, we kind of have three choices here. We can either look at it and say, oh, this is sponsored research. It has a vendor name in it and just ignore it. And that option sucks because if you get burned on this one and when you look back, you know, people are going to second guess and say, hey, you got an email here, e-discovery. It dropped in your mailbox. Maybe even a customer asked about how you are. And he didn't even respond to me.
But not just one customer, Jerry, multiple customers.
Everyone.
Right, everyone. That's the
problem. Every one of them. And then the second option is to research it and understand it. And very rare. Like, actually go through this, read all, and all of a sudden, you might your gut feel is this is stupid, this is overblown. But now you're allocating resources and highly paid resources. Like for people to even grok what's going on with this thing. And I'm not, I mean, for our audience, a lot of them are like, oh, I get it. I get, you know, signing firmware releases, whatever. That's a pretty small minutia of people, of real people. So you're investing a lot of people to read through this whole thing and properly risk rate it and ultimately say, eh, it's not that big of a deal for us. We'll wait for our scanners to bake this in. And we know that'll take 6 months, and then there'll be mediums, and we'll give IT a whole lot of time to upgrade because we don't really care. That's the correct way to handle this, but extremely expensive. And then the third option is every headline that comes in, call it a critical, dump tickets in Jira on engineering, panic. Why aren't you upgrading the BIOS IT? And by the way, what comes with that is going to the board the next quarter and explaining again for the 20th quarter in a row that IT is way behind on fixing anything. And that, look at security, we're so good because we've issued all these findings, but if only the rest of the company would get on board. And that's the path of least resistance for security teams. And I think that's why everybody hates us.
So let me offer a fourth option.
Okay.
And that fourth option, so when I was at the bank, one of the things that I had a chance to potentially inherit was the threat intelligence team. And I was like, ugh. I don't know if I want to do that, but that said, it made me think about, like, how do I make a threat intelligence team much more useful, much more effective at what they need to do? And the reality is that, as you pointed out, there's constant flooding of threats that we need to be able to triage. So the question is, what is the best way to triage that? Well, Mario, I don't know if you know, but there's a hurricane that's brewing in the Atlantic. Do you care? No, because you don't live on the East Coast. Okay, so you might care because you might have people that you know there, but aside from that fact, do you personally care in the context of your property and your assets that are largely probably West Coast located? And you would say no, because that doesn't matter. But that said, if there's some sort of threat intelligence that can give you the from which you can derive the specificity of what might it actually impact. If that triage can be done efficiently, then we can start saying this particular piece of threat intelligence I do need to route to somebody who's going to care about that, and then they're gonna actually want to hear about it, right? But if I'm giving you, Mario, hey, let me tell you the latest about this hurricane that's barreling through the Atlantic or potentially going barreling through the Atlantic, you're gonna be like, you're just creating more noise and drowning out the signal.
I used to do that, Sunil. I used to say this is a nothing burger. Okay, the problem is this thing is just metastasized itself. It's not just us, but our clients, our auditors, our board members. They hear about these headlines, and you know, like, so I could easily argue, no, that hurricane's really not going to impact any of our services that we provide to clients. But then they'll ask, well, do you leverage any vendor that's impacted by that? And so then you flood the system, because now you got to make sure all your critical vendors are not going to get impacted by that hurricane, and you need to do it, or else. I wish I could be more forward thinking and have the Constitution to block it. I had to create a team dedicated just to this stuff daily. Yeah. I hate to say that. And we had a lot of we worked on, you know, threat intelligence also reported to me, and we had a lot of visibility. We also didn't have a lot of visibility on other things. I get it, you know, it's always, but we knew what we knew. And it just, the more vendors you start using, the more customers that work with you, they're going to ask you here. They're going to ask you this. Mm-hmm. And you better be ready. And you can't just say, this is a nothing burger. You have to say, well, here's what we've done. Here's the critical vendors we've contacted. Nobody's impacted by this. Or yes, there's a few of them impacted. We're working with them, and they're going to have a solution X. And you just have to do that. Unfortunately, there's just no way around it for where I was at.
Yeah, well, Log4j is a great example where I don't know how many times you had to answer that question over and over again. At the end of the day, we just said, look, here's our website that just gives you the blanket statement around what we're doing. And I don't know if that was the best approach. But at the end of the day, we're going to have a lot of people asking. We all ask each other 100 times over. We have this we amplified our own DDoS against each other. That's essentially what we did.
Yeah. We do.
Yes.
We do.
So in that regard, I recognize that that's going to happen. Maybe we have to look at how do we avoid that amplification effect and DDoSing ourselves in the process.
I don't think it's going to slow down. All these outages or these, you know, cloud provider events, CrowdStrike, are you kidding me? This is just going to even get more. This is not going away, at least in the next 12 months. I think it's going to get worse.
Well, and you know, good chance to. We should have like a little sound that we play every time we crap on TPRM, on the state of TPRM. So let's go. So, good point, right? In contracting, I've said before, it's a leverage play, right? Whoever the bully is always gets their terms under the contract.
Yeah.
But even when it's a reasonable contract, it always says, if you have a massive vulnerability or breach that could directly affect us as a customer, you have to let us know. Now, Bank of America probably says, if you have any kind of vulnerability, you have to let us know, which I always thought was completely unrealistic. But if you can negotiate well, you could say, hey, look, if it affects you as a customer, and which is still pretty broad, right? If infrastructure, if it's going to take down the whole cloud environment, that's good enough. I would agree to that one. Says we're going to let you know. So there's no need for you to email me about Log4j at all. But it was really interesting. Every time another one of these things breaks and all the email storms go through and everybody's writing each other, that's implicitly saying that we didn't really mean it on the contract. Because contracts all say, you might not have heard of this Log4j thing, but we're affected and your data could be at risk, so we're going to let you know. That's the minimum satisfaction of most of the contracts and that we all argued over. And we're all acting like those things don't really exist or don't count, because now we're sending another email to ask the exact same question.
But Jerry, I got to think. Yeah, I like what you're saying, but like here's the reality in the world that I experience. You have some board member who sits, you know, some person who sits on your board. They might have not looked at your website or they may not have all the information readily available. They just hear these headlines, and they're going to say, as a board member, what the heck are you doing? What are you doing with this? How are you handling this?
Can't be dismissive.
And you better be ready. You better tell your boss or yourself or your CEO, whoever's going to talk to that board member, we've done X and no, we're not impacted. And you better be ready for that.
Well, so we did just two pieces to it. Sunil's right about when he said triage, right? It's all about being able to. But I don't think it's about. I'm not a fan of the crown jewel theory. I think that's really steered people in the wrong direction too much, because that. So the triage is hot right now. As somebody who screens a lot of deals and VCs, I'm seeing a lot of action in the automation of triage, and it's about cutting down that massive funnel of critical vulns that to make it into board reports into the 10% of them we should really care about. And I'm glad to see that. I think that's a great devotion of resource. But there's a lot more to it than what is the asset, because the crown jewels drives towards CMDB, having a database of all your servers, and you're going to – someone in GRC is ticking, this server is important, this server not so important. That's completely unrealistic. And also, even if it were right, you break in through the unimportant servers to move laterally to the important ones. So I don't think it's more as much about the assets as it is about the exploitability. Log4j, for example. If Log4j can be hit, Coca-Cola, let's say they have we always joked about a sweepstakes site, meaning it's non-critical, it's not going to affect production, it shouldn't affect revenue. That's not a crown jewel. If there's a Log4j on there that someone in a Starbucks can find and exploit and get a shell, I'm still excited about that if I'm at Coca-Cola. It's a really big deal. I don't know what they can move laterally. They could backdoor, they could keystroke log on the thing, and then when the admin, and by the way, there isn't a special admin team for the sweepstakes server, you know that, they're going to get credentials. I'm very concerned about that. Now let's take, and let's just pretend that making sugar water is really mission critical to the world, but let's take whatever the crown jewel is of Coca-Cola. Actually, I picked a bad example, but of the nuclear reactor, whatever it may be.
You're and in Atlanta, instead, man. How can you be Valmont and Coca-Cola?
I'm not. It's equal opportunity. It's a discretionary good, I think. But let's say you find a Log4j jar file, old, not just old, exploitable worst case version. And this happens all the time. The tools find it, and it's sitting on disk in a directory with probably the three other versions. It's the working directory. It's not loaded. It's not in memory. It's not exploitable, but it's on the crown jewel. Is that a crit? Hell no. So it's not about the asset. It's about the exploit, pictures or it didn't happen. And that's just really sophisticated and hard. And by the way, the push to have privileged, agent-based, authenticated, root-level vulnerability assessors causes this issue more than anything.
I've lost that argument, Jerry. I've lost that. Look.
Which side were you on?
The minute you do anybody doing FedRAMP knows this problem. Okay, even if the freaking jar file is not being used since my grandmother was around, you know, it doesn't matter. In fact, FedRAMP is actually pretty hardcore about it, right? They're like,
Really?
They're like, you know, you can't have a jar file that's two or three versions old. They're starting to get that prescriptive, okay?
Yeah. The JVM versions for servers that don't JVM run Java, versions. That don't run Java apps.
So I'm going to make an argument. My desire is to go with the easy path, right? We all think want to go in the easy path when it comes to being asset-centric or, let's say, vulnerability-centric, which is what I think you were articulating. Or exploit-centric. Well, threat, vulnerability, or impact-centric. And I would argue, when I say the easy path, whatever data is easiest to obtain in any one of those three to help inform my decision-making is what I'm looking for. And sometimes it's really hard to get data on all three of those. But I would argue that I've been able to come up with a way to obtain relatively easily one of those, and that's the impact side of the equation.
Yeah.
And the way that I've done that is through, for those who know, the DIE triad, distributed, immutable, and ephemeral. And that allows me to quickly calibrate on how important this asset is. But let me offer the notion of how important that asset is should and does drive our behavior around should I pay attention to this particular vulnerability. Take the President of the United States. Some little, small little skin mole that pops up. I'm pretty sure that, I mean, just because of how important that resource is to the country, you're going to have a doctor taking a look at it, right? Whereas most of us won't. And so I think the notion of having an understanding of, given that this is a critical asset, a really, really critical asset, if there is a very small if there is any kind of vulnerability that shows up, yes, we may actually want to pay attention to it because of the importance of that asset. If I can obtain that information about the importance of the asset easily, it does, I think, in my view, help me calibrate my decisions faster and say, okay, are these the ones I should pay attention to or not? You know, the converse, conversely, if it's an asset that's not very important, okay, then I may deprioritize the vulnerabilities, even if that vulnerability is severe. The real question is, are we calibrating our understanding of impact of that asset properly? Because we may think that it's not an important asset because, well, it's just a menu server for the cafeteria, okay? But if I look at my my DIE attributes, DIE, well, that's a long-lived server that's been up and running for and has never been rebooted, okay? I would count that as an important server just because it has a long life. It's not ephemeral. Therefore, you need to pay attention to it.
I like that. I like that. Hi, before we go off this topic, I to kind of round out that portrayal for the layperson of what goes on, you know, the more I think about these, it is so much easier to panic over all these things as a CISO and just throw it over the fence and task everybody else with it. Because I went through this PK fail thing, and then this one that came out about, oh, it has a name too, sitting ducks. So domain hijacking. And the way that these things read are like millions of devices vulnerable to PK fail, right? Or what does this other one say? There are over a million exploitable target domains on any given day.
Yeah.
How can a board director on a flight read that and not feel obligated to ask the CISO?
Totally.
Right? And like I looked at that one. To me, that means that Coca-Cola.com might be hijacked tonight. And I don't blame somebody for jumping to that conclusion. When I read it, it was, oh, some stupid old sweepstakes.coca-cola.com that we sub-delegated to a different authoritative DNS service 6 years ago and then abandoned, and one of the vulnerable ones might have a fake sweepstakes site. That's a yawn burger, from at a board level at least. But this is just indicative of how everything has to be trumped up as the most important thing in the world just to get the likes and the clicks. And it really increases the cost for cybersecurity.
So let's also then consider, is there something to learn, aside from the actual vulnerability that's being brought forth, is there a systemic issue that could be considered that, so if I think about threat intelligence and what I would like to do from a tactical standpoint versus a strategic standpoint, I think part of what we're not wanting to get buried in is all the tactical, hey, latest vendor finding, and we're like, okay, do I really want to pay attention to that or not? And a lot of times we would say, nope, don't care. But the strategic threat intelligence aspect of that function should say, is there something that's more systemic that we're seeing that's causing us to have this type of issue emerge? And do we see that ourselves in our own environment? And that's where I don't know if we don't spend enough time on that part of the equation. And I don't know if there are companies out there that do that specifically. I would love to hear about that, because that's really where I think we would collectively get more value.
My approach on this has been for a long time when it comes to Intel, the news Intel overlap. All Intel is news at some degree, but when it comes to like these vulnerabilities, right? I say you take a piece of Intel, any kind of product, and you review it and you figure out, you know, what was the objective of the attacker? Meaning at high level, were they trying to do extortion? Were they trying to do fraud? Because there's some groups that are generally affiliated with a certain objective for a while. And then you look at the TTPs that were involved in that. And then you start there. And you're, do we also care about fraud? Okay, well, someone got hit with fraud. What were the TTPs? Do we have coverage for that? And that's where it begins. You can't do that with these news pieces that are academic research, because nothing's happened yet. But if you wait 6 hours on Log4j, you can. Because everybody's getting popped with Log4j. Well, what if nobody's been popped yet? Go back to bed. You can't run a security org. I mean, unless you're running the nuclear plant, then sure, way to go, critical infrastructure. But for the other 99%, don't burn all your shareholder money on these press releases, because it's just irresponsible.
I'm just going to poo-poo on this whole thing, okay, guys? Because you both are you've run very sophisticated shops, and I can appreciate that. But the reality is, we're not getting out of this headline business anytime soon. I'm going to be really contrarian. I'm going to be negative about it.
Adversarial?
It's just, yeah, it's adversarial, man. I think, unfortunately, to say, hey, we're going to take a risk-based approach on all of this stuff, great, show it to me. How? And you're going to continue to have these headlines happening. It's not going to stop. So you guys are sophisticated. I appreciate it. But it ain't stopping.
That's a good counterpoint.
Oh, but Jerry, would you be more convinced if it had a logo?
Well, somebody recently told me that that their workflow had to be like, if it has a logo, then ignore it. It's got a point. Yeah. All right. Moving on. So another interesting cyber story that came up was KnowBe4 had this pretty cool announcement saying we had hired a North Korean. And they were in our network, and we figured it out. And so, and the way I read it was kind of a, hey, we're sharing here out of A, full disclosure, and B, kind of a warning to everybody else this could be going on. And it is going on. It's been going for a long time. And in this case, there was, if you hear that, if anybody hears, hey, there was a North Korean that fraudulently, meaning they weren't allowed to be hired, and they were hired pretending to be from a different country with false IDs, then you kind of assume that they were there to hack Western infrastructure, destroy, kind of sabotage. And in this case, there was an element of that. The employee, the day they got their laptop, they started dumping session history and trying to see if it was reassigned from another employee and if there'd be creds in it, which is really JV, noisy.
Totally.
To me, that's not nation state. Like day one, double click, and guess how to get caught, because there was CrowdStrike on the damn thing. So anybody would know, oh, there's CrowdStrike on here. Maybe they'd subvert it. Maybe they would just give up, whatever. But everything that happened was super JV. And the fact that they were DPRK, or the fact they were North Korean, doesn't mean they were DPRK. So I mentioned this because I ran into this with a client. Oh, it had to be over a year ago. And in that case, someone reached out to the company and said, hey, this person, you know them, they're on your team, they're actually a North Korean operative. And they did some cursory reviews, but said, that's probably just a disgruntled domestic squabble or something like that. And then the FBI reached out and said, hey, you really need to take a look. Mm-hmm. And when they did, they were North Korean. But I did some research at the time. And there was actually, I think it was FBI that put out a warning in May of 23 about this very thing. And what we saw and what they reported were all about generating income. Just straight up. And they were writing good code. Mm. They were coming in and they were getting the job done. They were great. And there was no back doors. There was no malware. There was no sabotage. They were just trying to get 180 grand a year funneled back to the mothership. And that was it. And that's crazy. That's the new reality. So when you see this headline where you are worried about backdoors and infiltration and state-sponsored espionage or just an HR cleanup?
So to your point earlier, this has been going on for quite some time. I remember one of the first instances of something like this popping up was almost, for at least my first recollection of it was almost 8 years ago. And I made a mistake in how I interpreted it, because I thought it was intended. So here was the guidance I got from as a result of this incident. It was, all future interviews must be, you must actually see this person and recognize that this person is who they're asked, and who they purport to be. These interviews must happen in person or have some sort of video component to it. And at the time I was thinking, wait a second, hold on. Aren't we, there's a lot of bias that goes into hiring. Okay. And at the time I was like, wait, why are we reintroducing bias into our hiring decisions?
Yeah.
And that was my first reaction. I was like, wait a second, that seems like we're going the wrong direction. Little did I know, the reason why we're doing this was because this type of scenario. And to Jerry's point, it wasn't a, it was purely just funneling income, as he mentioned. That said, I mean, there's other, once you have access, you can do a lot of other interesting things, I'm sure. But it was purely just income generation. And I would say that happens. I would say the prevalence of this is going to be much greater than I think most people will realize.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether it's because of North Koreans or just people in other parts of the world. If you remember, there was an old story from even longer ago where some Verizon worker was offshoring his work to somebody in India. I mean, it's the same sort of scenario, right? This is happening in ways that are much more prevalent than I think we all realize.
Yeah, yeah. When I first read this thing, I didn't take the whole HR angle. I should have maybe spent a little more time. I thought, man, this is so JV, just like Jerry's saying. Who does this sort of stuff? And then I started the conspiracy part of me started thinking, well, maybe this is a sacrificial lamb. Maybe what they're doing is, it's a security firm. I'm going to give the North Koreans a little bit more props. I'm thinking, okay, security firm, let's find out their controls. And let's just go start easy. Let's go get loud, download well-known malware on freaking laptops. Are you kidding me, really? I mean, come on, who does that? Unless you're trying to poke at their controls and then do something else later. Yeah. I mean, it just seems it was so. I mean, my goodness, it's so sophomoric. I couldn't stop like wondering why it was so lame of him, you know.
Well, and you know, a lot comes into this, right? We're on this rapid trajectory that got triggered by the pandemic and the work from home exodus, yeah. Because it wasn't just I don't know who they are anymore. It was also an element I don't care who they are anymore, right? So if you hire someone in Brooklyn at $250,000 a year, and they outsource not to one but two people in India, who are both pretty damn good, and the result is the output of everything that you wanted for $250,000. And HR feels whole, well, maybe not HR. Engineering feels whole, right? Now it's North Korea, then all of a sudden you got all these sanctions issues and all of that. But if it's somewhere that you're allowed to work anyway, we're getting closer and closer to whether or not people care. And there's a lot of this going on, and it only comes up when there's a degradation in the work quality or the FBI calls or something like that, right?
Well, for what it's worth, I'm looking forward to the day when we get a headline that says, security firm alarmed to discover the remote employee is ChatGPT.
Hey, at least they got clean motivations. Hey, so one that's orthogonal to this, that I heard about, I knew a company that did, so you know whenever you're with a really brutal vendor, you end up hiring people that just know that vendor's software. That's always a red flag. If you have a job title that's Archer engineer or Workday engineer or something like that, then maybe there's a problem there. Talk about switching costs, right? So in this case, they had that going on, and they hired someone. I think Workday was the vendor in this case, but they hired people to work on the Workday instance and customize it and tune in all the crap that you get into. And I think it was Workday or another Workday customer that called and said, hey, we're seeing your company's name in some code that our developer's checking it. So we think maybe good code, sure. But like in the comments, you know, or in the old endpoints or whatever it's going to be, it was for company A, but this work was getting done for company B. And I don't remember if it was direct or through Workday or whatever, but they ultimately told company A, hey, there's someone out there in the world who's checking in code that had some comments. It looks kind of suspicious. So they start pulling on all the threads, and sure enough, they know that employee's name. Like, oh, yeah, that person was supposed to be working for us, and they're not only working for you at the same time, but they're reusing code, and there's all kinds of badness going on. Again, great, super productive employee. And then here's the punchline. So they they confront the employee, and they go, hey, sorry, but we're on to you here. You know, we got a report and we checked it all out, and it's been obvious that you've also been working for another company and reusing our code. And you know what the guy said? Which one? That's pretty common. I'm speculating. Sorry, what do I know? You're remote, you're at home, you're doing good and noble work. Let's say you don't mess up and actually steal the code or whatever it is, so you feel like you're doing the right thing. I think there's sizable chunk of people that are making $200,000 four times over, five times over. Does that reflect on the company and that their expectations, the bar is so low that someone could get away with that and they still think they're great?
Well, going back to my comment earlier, firms realizing that their remote employee is using ChatGPT to accelerate their work five times over is going to be more and more of a common occurrence. And I think that's we should see this happen. We should be ready for that. But is that a I'm not sure how we get ready for that outside of more monitoring, which I'm somewhat averse to. Like, yeah. No one wants to have more Big Brother per se. But at the same time, it is the reality of how work's going to be done in the future.
But wait a minute. Wait a second. This is open source. This is the same thing as open source. Folks, we are using common code used by everybody.
Yeah, good point.
Right. It's open source. All right. Do we have a problem with that? Really? So we've already embraced this kind of model. And we get a little bit kind of, I guess, we feel like, well, we're paying you for the service. Your code should only be dedicated to us. And you should not be reusing your code. Are you kidding me? All of us have coded. We've reused our own code. We reuse other people's codes all the time. This to me is like, come on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we used to call it hit it and quit it when you had a DLP right before someone put in their notice. And it was 50% of the time those were the contacts from salespeople, and the other 50% it was code.
Yeah.
And they were never trying to, you know, take it all back to TPRK. It was always like, I want to remember this trick I figured out. You know, it wasn't okay. Affidavits, wiping it, all that. But it wasn't evil. It's just sloppy.
So let's talk about controls. What are controls for that remote worker scenario? Or what are controls for how we think about whether we want to avoid a single worker working for 10 different companies? I'm spitballing here. I'm not suggesting this is that those actions are moral or immoral or whatever. It's just if we wanted to consider a control, then there are a couple options to consider. For one, let's say in the scenario of the remote IT worker and the North Koreans, they were sending laptops to a IT worker mule farm, effectively, where they all get concentrated in one particular place. So essentially, the way I would look at that is that's sort of like an open relay. And we in email, we know we dealt with that in the past, and we found ways to address it through tools like Spam House. Do we need a similar like Mule House type of service where we can collectively capture that and know when a bunch of laptops from different companies are ending up in the same place? Here's another similar sort of feature. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but something that even the payroll providers can potentially help us with. Again, I'm just throwing out ideas, but I don't know if I necessarily want these ideas to be implemented. I'm just throwing them out there for consideration. But there's only so many payroll providers. And let's suppose I contractually, in my contract with an employee, I say, hey, you really cannot be working for other companies. And so we're going to tell the payroll provider, we're going to put a flag into your for our payroll provider to say, this person should not be getting payroll from other companies. So if two companies happen to use, let's say, ADP, and somewhere they flag that this person is getting two paychecks from the same from two different companies at the same time, then maybe there's a signal that comes back that says, hey, this person seems to be moonlighting. Okay, just ideas, right? But the perspective of instead of saying, okay, we can't do anything about this, let's consider what are some controls that might work if we think about the broader ecosystem.
All right. Back on info stealers. This thing seems to keep on coming up, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys looked through this thing, but I keep seeing headlines and specific threat intel that has a TTP, if you will, in it of info stealer, meaning something's just sitting on a endpoint. It's pulling in, whether it's keystrokes or browser entry, archiving them off somewhere where they're tagged with where the endpoint is. You know, this is something typed into Bank of America, this is something typed into petstore.com, whatever, to allow people to then choose which bits they want to double-click on and pull out of here. So there was an article that that Josh Lefkowitz of Flashpoint shared, and I mean, I think he was very specifically trying to say, man, this info stealer is a plague, and it's involved in a lot more than we realized. So in this case, it was a 2022 breach of MediaBank, and I guess that the details were finally unsealed, if you will, as the court case proceeded, And so now in 2024, it's not like we necessarily, they just figured it out, but now we at least as public know about what happened. And in this case, what it says is that someone's working on their, well, MediaBank probably, endpoint, and they log into Chrome with their personal profile. They save some credentials, bookmark, passwords, and those get synchronized, and then they log into their personal profile at home. And so even though MediaBank deployed some awesome controls on the on their own endpoint and they couldn't have InfoStealer there, home computer, Wild West, totally different ballgame, InfoStealer's on there, grabs all these credentials, and they're usable, right, which is its own problem. You kind of got to think all single-factor credentials you can't trust anymore. So that was the point here. What was interesting to me about this was that it kind of elicited the normal, the whole crowd of security folks all pointing out different lessons learned out of here. And some of the narrative that came out was you should never store passwords in a browser. Do you guys think that's true?
As opposed to, let's say, a password manager?
I mean, that could be part of your argument, without a doubt, but it doesn't have to be either or. Right? You also could have none of the above.
But even with a password manager, you're still going to get a token, a session token, and that's going to be valid, and that's still valid for a certain period. Some of them can be even more than a week, quite honestly.
So in my view, the usability of security is a major factor, right? Mm-hmm. And to have your ability to save and not have to, well, one, the ability to have complex passwords, it may become easier because you can save them in the browser. I think the net effect of that is much better for security than having to not have that, because we think that that's an attack vector that we're concerned about.
You know what I was thinking about as well? It's you know, you're talking about this attack vector. What about these phones, the smart devices that we use, not just laptops? And we're trying to be productive, right? We're trying to have our employees, you know, you work from home as well. You work at work. You work from home. You work on the weekends. You know, you got to keep working. And sometimes these employees, they want to use their smart devices that are not monitored or owned by the company. But we continue to let them use it because we want them to be productive. And those become conduits, as Neil, maybe you're highlighting, but they become conduits as well for these info stealers. It's not just the laptops at home, your own personal laptops. It's your phones, and it's all for productivity. When's the last time you had a conversation with your IT department or your CEO and you're telling them, hey, we need to replace everybody's phone with work phones, and it's going to cost $5 to $10 million.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and that wasn't in the budget, by the way. And what tools are we going to use after that?
Yeah, I agree. You're hitting on a lot of third rails, right? So, I think that goes back again to, like, from what you just said, I think the average executive's take is issuing corporate phones is more secure, will give us more security. No one's going to argue with that, they say. The question is it worth the friction? I don't think that's accurate. I don't think that's the right math. That we haven't set up the equation right. I think issuing corporate phones degrades your security because you stop worrying about the personal phones because you got the problem solved. You issue these corporate devices, and they throw them in a box. When somebody's at the pool, which phone are they bringing with them? Not that one. Oh, and by the way, it has a 15-character password, too. So if they even made it home without crashing their car trying to enter the damn thing, then they're throwing it away. So now all of a sudden you paper it up. It's not my fault if something goes wrong. And, of course, they're using the BYODs. And they're not talking about, you're not recording their conversations about business if you're supposed to in a regulated market. You know, what are they syncing over to there?
Or you're getting texts from your IT department from somebody that you have no controls in, and then you give them your password.
Oh, yeah, because you're desensitized to all of that. Exactly. And on and on. So I pause and challenge the first part of it. But when it comes to the browser thing, though, I think that shows like kind of this theme here where people don't quite double click it enough, because I fell in this exact pathway where on the browsers, it's tempting to not people store passwords. And by the way, if anyone has ever not allowed someone to, like when password managers first came out, the archetypical CISOs were like, oh, that's bad. I don't know who the hell this company is. You can't store your password, and that's terrible. So they blocked them left and right. And that same CISO was blocking storing passwords in browsers. Setting up a workplace where you can't use password managers and you can't store them in browsers. That's awful.
Right?
The workarounds people will find. Right? I mean, as a CISO, your job is to take the burden of stupid passwords off people. That's number one. Everything else, I think, is kind of secondary to that. So I'm a fan of storing the passwords in the browsers. Stop syncing them. Don't let people log in with their Gmail account into the home browser, which will then sync it over. Or, you know, you can let them log in, but just via GPO, you could block sync. So that's pretty cool. And then when you type it, it won't go across.
Or you contain your syncing within the enterprise as opposed to having it leak outside the enterprise.
Well, if you log in with your corporate credential, then you sync to your corporate credential, and you're not allowed to log in from your home computer.
Right.
And vice versa.
Let me add some nuance to the password manager within the context of an enterprise. First and foremost, we should generally be saying that there is some form of identity provider that doesn't require you to actually have to memorize multiple passwords inside the enterprise anyway, right? So if you have to memorize multiple passwords, if you don't have single sign-on, in other words, you're probably doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. And so there was an earlier argument to say, well, why do I really need a password manager when there's only one password that people need to memorize? The other consideration is, look, I would support password managers in enterprise only so that people can start using password managers at home, right? Mm-hmm. Let me give you a free license that you can just give everyone in your family. Mm-hmm. You don't have to just take the friction out of using password managers. Get comfortable with using password managers because we want you to use them at home as well. And the example of the info stealer here is simply that this wouldn't have stopped the info stealer issue as much. But the simple fact that people still get compromised because they reuse passwords all the time at home, and that just causes a lot of issues that may not necessarily directly affect work, but definitely affects the livelihood of our employees and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I would say I would support password manager use inside of an enterprise, if only just so that we can make sure that people use it at home too.
Well, here's my adversarial moment on this one. I think Chrome is a password manager, a viable password manager at that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I try to play devil's advocate, maybe it's angel's advocate, I'm not keeping up here, then one might argue that, look, LastPass or 1Password, and I don't use those. I use Chrome. That's the password manager I use. So one might argue, like, those probably force you to do something very secure, I hope, meaning you probably can't have a single-factor master key to it, I hope, I assume. Whereas Chrome is kind of, you know, take all comers. So they want to also let you log in pretty easily because it's not always a password manager. And if it is, it's not always for important creds. So you probably can do dumber things with that password manager called Chrome. But you know, from my point of view, the IDP is gold. So like I think that Chrome login, that Google login, better be super bomb-proof. I better throw at it everything that I can because there's a lot behind that login besides just the passwords. So once I'm comfortable with that login and the protection behind that account, then I think it's a damn good password manager.
I think it fails, Jerry, if you allow extensions to be installed on these browsers. Okay, we go back. Remember, Sunil, we had this conversation. I think we did it in a couple of episodes ago. If you're going to do that, are you going to allow extensions? And if you're going to allow extensions, are you allowing all extensions in the world? Or are you going to control those extensions? And are you going to control those extensions in people's personal laptops or devices? You see where we're going with this?
But, well, for one, I want to make a joke about all the password managers being extensions. The third-party ones.
Touché.
But beyond that, if you use a third-party password manager, aren't you still exposed to extensions? I mean, they may not grab the SQLite database off the disk or whatever like with Chrome, but they can get it once it's supplicated by the password manager, right?
True.
Once it's typed into the form by 1Password, an extension could just soon get that, right? I think.
Well, hopefully there's proper segmentation, security, you know, boundaries that are created between extensions. Chrome has a pretty good model, right?
They're highly motivated.
Yeah, very highly motivated.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, hey, like one last thing that I think we were going to talk about here was about I've seen a lot of discussions about social engineering and deepfakes and that sort of thing. And some of them are instances of it happening. We're starting to hear them. and they seem credible, meaning that the people that are cited are actually real humans. You can get in touch with and verify. But a lot of them, of course, are from the security community that are kind of trying to get ahead of this, and they know they're going to get asked by their board director to bring us back to the beginning of the episode, and they want to have a good story around this. So I've talked to a few companies about it for deepfake detection, deepfake prevention. What's the state of play in your minds? Is this the kind of thing that if you were a sitting CISO would be keeping you up at night, and what's the path to remediating?
So first of all, I think that the deepfake detection and creation is an ever-escalating battle of CPU. I can come up with a deepfake that is not detectable with lower-level CPU. I put more CPU in to make it to detect it, and now I can detect that type of deepfake. Well, what's going to happen next is you throw more CPU at it, and it becomes not detectable. Mm-hmm. So it's a never-ending battle of the 11-foot wall, 12-foot ladder, you know, and cycle through that process. The fundamental problem that we have is that there's no root of trust for the content that we create, and we've solved this problem before. There are such things as deepfake websites, okay, www.google.com, that points to some Chinese website with a certificate owned by some Chinese, you know, self-signed certificate, right? That's a deepfake of Google. How do we solve that problem? We have certificate authorities. And if and we expect those certificate authorities to have good, robust measures to ensure that root of trust is protected. And if you don't, then they get ejected like Entrust, right? But at the end of the day, it narrows the attack path. It narrows the attack path significantly and gives us as consumers of that content a more clearly identifiable assurance of, is this a deep fake or not? And whether it's a website or media or email or whatever it might be, I think that's going to have to be the real long-term solution.
You know, there's this thing going on in the Congress right now, in the U.S. Congress, where it's in the Senate right now, and I don't know if it's going to pass, but the whole thing has been about this new AI power fakes, the impersonating candidates. And right now, the Senate is struggling, because as it turns out, you could use these things, and there is no law against using them, folks. Headlines, right? And the senators are struggling to implement this law. It's so basic. Dude, don't do it. Each party gets, you know, nobody wins, but they can't get, I mean, Mitch McConnell is opposing it. Really? So Sunil, I hear what you're saying. I'd love to think our better angels. But if we're struggling, we've been making this a law. I don't know where we're going to go with this.
I think there are reasons why we should have some consideration of laws. I'm not sure which laws are appropriate in this particular case versus more fundamental design issue. Mm. And I would argue that we in the technology side of the equation should say there is a we have seen this problem before. And let's work towards solving this problem because we know there's a technological solution. What I would argue is there's a group called the C2PA, the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity. And what they're doing is they're basically saying, we're going to have a root of trust around the content that is created through your phone, through Adobe, through whatever, okay? And if people can now receive that certificate of authenticity, you know that this is from whatever source. And we lack that today. We lack it because the infrastructure is not there yet, but it's starting to be built, and we just need to be able to support and accelerate that. But we also lack a more fundamental piece that is also unfortunately quite political, which is some form of identification for us. Yeah, some
national identification for like the whole, yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. And yeah. unfortunately, that is politicized for a good, you know, for a lot of reasons. But that is a foundational thing that's going to be needed as well.
Oh my goodness, I'm thinking about Roblox. Imagine if any of you have kids and you know what's going on with Roblox, right? How do you know that other player on the other side is your kid, is another kid? And there's,
it's not.
There's,
it's, I, exactly, I can help you with this one.
Right? Oh, no. I get gray thinking about that stuff. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I deal with this all the time. Well, Sunil, to kind of counter your point, I think you're launching us on a good path towards developing better, stronger first string authentication, if you will. So if we get to where you're saying, and by the way, I can't believe I hadn't thought of that. And then I was at the Decibel event at RSA, and they had Kevin Mandy on, and this came up. And he basically very quickly said, oh, yeah, we're going to have to. I mean, and he wasn't even saying like this is obvious or easy, like even this is hard. He's saying we're going to have to sign conversations, right? So that, yeah. And you know, for anybody that's new to that, either you have a central root of trust that everybody agrees with, or you've established symmetrical keys. But bottom line is the first time you met Mario, something happened on your phone that says, okay, this is Mario's phone. And from then on, it always has a green check. And then when it has a red X, you're like, oh, that's not really Mario. So I think you're going on the right path to getting the green check. But the problem is, no one, when you're an adversary, you don't need volume. You don't have to break in 90% of the time, in which case the green check would thwart you. You're in the, hey, I'm Mario and I got a new phone. And by the way, Mario's going to get a new phone. He's going to lose his damn phone in Portugal and go to the shop and get one, and he's going to have a red X.
And that happens all the time.
You might not be joking. But, I mean, it's literally going to happen. And that's it's a downgrade attack, as I like to say.
Yeah.
So when you have to say, okay, here's our really cool thing we're going to do, but we know it's going to have exceptions, and what are we going to do? And you got to have an adversarial game through that and say, okay, well, the CFO lost their phone. They're naked on a beach, whatever it takes. As an organization, do we want to be able to get them in and to do work? And yes is an okay answer. And then what are we going to take to go through that? And then if I'm a bad guy and I know that, how can I abuse it? And 9 times out of 10, you're going to say, hell yeah, I can abuse it.
That's what they're doing right now. That's what they're doing right now. They're abusing all these, like, you know, that's, if you hear all these breaches.
Well, how about backup codes for first persistent MFA?
Exactly. Right?
Of course you do. I mean, you have so much time when you're a bad guy. It's so much fun to walk through all of these little, Rubik's Cube.
When you don't have to follow rules?
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to be adversarial?
I think the first thing that we should keep in mind is that to know explicitly when a downgrade attack is occurring, to be able to give signal to the person that's on the receiving end that needs to make that authentication decision to say, hey, downgrade attack, or downgrade, it doesn't have to be an attack, just downgrade in process, okay? Which then should trigger some additional safeguards that says that should cause the event itself, the managing of this process, to potentially slow down. Now, we all know there's the attackers come in with a sense of urgency. You know, no, I can't. I need this now, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if given that we are in a downgraded state, I'm sorry, but we actually have specific mechanisms that we've put in, where the person on the receiving, on the authenticating end says, look, I don't really have a choice. The system itself is slower at this lower level, okay? And because it's slower at this lower level, we just have to deal with the fact that it's just slower, whatever that might be. Okay.
And you see that with Apple and Google, right? There's things that you could do. Yeah, when a minute your 3-year-old got a hold of your phone, you figure that one out, right? You can't try again for 4 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Guilty.
Yeah, definitely.
Guilty.
But I could say we test these things all the time, right? Because when you get into like security theater, like the big custody banks and you know, work for clearinghouses, so it was involved on the security administration side for these big custody banks, and they all are in this arms race to prove who's more secure, which means they want to mail you more physical devices. You remember, if any of you have been Swift admins, they send from Belgium these 2.5 passwords to 2 different humans over the post, and they go through the same damn mailroom and all that, but it's just a bunch of theater. And oh, and then the best part is everybody hires the same consulting group who says, okay, I need all your emails, your secret decoder rings, and okay, put them all in a binder, and they walk off.
It's Kabuki security theater, man. Kabuki security theater.
It is. But I remember, I think it was you're, you know, where you used to work, Sunil, but whatever.
That's why I was grinning, yes.
Yeah, right. So we used to call it the calculator. It was like a little thing, and you push in the numbers, and all of a sudden you get off the thing. And, oh, my God. Yeah. But I do remember also, anytime you call in, they wanted to know, or maybe it was online, but they wanted your answers to your secret questions, right? What's your favorite car? What was your first girlfriend's name? Whatever it was. And, of course, there were, like, length limitations on those, like, God forbid you dated Pam, right? Sorry, her name's not long enough. That won't do. It's just ridiculous. But I always remember, because those would throw me into such a rage that I would just always type, you know, kind of rage rants into those things instead of my actual answers, because at least they'd be unique on each line, save them away. And then inevitably I'd call up and they'd say, okay, Mr. Perullo, if that's really your real name, all right, what's your favorite car? And you can tell that they have to have fuzzy matching, right? Meaning you can't have to require a certain punctuation in everything, because otherwise if your team was Mets and you typed in with a capital M and now you're trying a lowercase m, it wouldn't work. So it had to actually be symmetrically encrypted, revealed to the customer service agent, and they could see it, so they could see if you're on the right path, which is super fallible in itself.
By the way, just real quickly on that point, there was a study that was done, and I can try to find it, where they were doing these authentication questions, and the attacker mumbled the answer.
Yeah.
And the person on the receiving end said, oh, okay, that's correct.
Yeah.
The person on the receiving end will anticipate the answer and think that what you said is the answer when it was just a mumble.
In financial services, it was, what's your favorite sports team? Well, first you pick a New York team. That's easy. You say Mets. And I remember listening to recorded conversations. Mets. No, think football. Oh, Giants. All right. Now we're in. Yeah. But what I could always tell is a symmetry, because if somebody would read and it said said Samantha, and they're waiting to hear what I have to say, and they say, okay, what's your favorite, blah, blah, blah. But in my case, they would always say, like, okay, what was your first car? And I'd start talking, and like, and I could tell they were reading my long rant. And they're like, I'm going to have to get a manager on the line. But I'd always make it through. That's the point. So the downgrade is what you have to figure out. When I put in garbage, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
So I've seen some really good tech on the front line, the green check mark side on this. It does involve either a source of truth, like driver's license and national ID databases, and it all involves in good times and peacetime establishing the trust that then you can go back and verify in wartime under pressure. I mean, you validate the ID when they're onboarded, so that later on when they supply an ID, you can match up to that. Otherwise, it's too late. But I do think it's going to come all down to procedure and backups, and someone's going to have to hold the line and say, you need to fly here and walk in and subject yourself to the potential of getting arrested before I'm going to trust you. And the last thing I'll add on all that is, if you ever wanted the gold standard in this stuff, go to the crypto companies, because they've been getting hit super hard with all the resources in the world for a long time now. And they know
Your optimism for both of you. You know, I if you were both a company and trying to sell me this whole, you know, national identifier, I'm sorry, I wouldn't invest. There's too many dead bodies in past history. Sorry, it ain't gonna happen.
Just saying that there's a need, but you know, actually, I would also admire the fact that both WhatsApp and iMessage, or at least Apple, they have a form of this authenticated identity. Apple has the advanced message security. Is it easy to set up? No. Okay. But once you do set it up, yes, you do have that. It's not really a green check mark, but there is a check mark to the identities that you have authenticated.
Yeah.
And if someone's trying to spoof it, again, then you know that's a downgrade.
And my grandma's going to be able to do that, Sunil?
No.
People's grandmothers and grandparents, you know what I mean?
But arguably, to that point, like, you want those people to have an easy experience to know that it is my daughter's calling, and my daughter is really in trouble and really needs my money, rather than some, you know, attack.
Well, I mean, I remember, I hope it's still not like this, but I think it was certainly 20 years ago to, let's say, 10 years ago, every self-avowed security expert had to have a PGP key, right? And they didn't encrypt the emails, because anyone could read them, and they knew that, because the thing doesn't work. But they would sign them, because that was just enough to say, look at my security chops. And 80% of them would fail validation. I was in Outlook all day warning, signature invalid from Proofpoint, right? From Cisco, from all these security companies, they all had to try to pretend they were secure. If I ignored every message that said invalid signature, I would have never done anything at all, which might have actually been great considering where they're coming from. But my point was, you know, it's totally absolute theater. And if the same thing happens on the phones and there's red X's and people just ignore it, then what was the point? But if the message said green check mark, yes, this is from Sunil. Hey, Jerry, I need you to wire me $50,000. Hold on. I don't care about any green check marks at all. It's context, right? And if there's a red X and it says, Jerry, I think that opinion is stupid, I'm not questioning it for a second. It's all about what's on the line here if I trust this message.
And yet millions of people continue to fall for it.
Yeah. Yeah, red X is and a stupid message. well, good. Well, thanks, guys. We went through a lot of stuff as usual. Before we part for today, any predictions for the next week here?
Well, just for those who, I think this is going to be recorded or shared a little bit afterwards, but for those in the Middle East, it's getting serious.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. With downgrade, with downstream impacts from economics to cybersecurity and everything in between, for sure.
Yeah. So stay safe out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Hoping against statistics that things somehow turn around over there. All right. Well, thanks, guys. Fun as always, and I look forward to talking after Black Hat and DEF CON. I'm not going, but, man, stay strong, whoever's out there. I bet we'll get a lot of listeners while people are just looking for something to do instead of wandering down the 110-degree street to get to a casino. All right. Well, thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.